ringer here, filling in these last 2 days of this week. I'm a New Testament professor at the Lutheran School of Theology in Chicago. And I want to emphasize that because, as you see, our texts today are from the Old Testament. So I will do my very best, but all of you are probably as much an expert on this text as I am. So feel free to jump into the conversation. So welcome to Jubilee Day. What I thought we could start by reading is the section of Leviticus 25 that this text comes from, and then we'll read around other parts of it too, and also go into some of these other texts. And at the end, I'm going to attempt to bring in global warming, aka climate change and climate debt, climate slavery, because this is the book that I'm working on now, and I always get great ideas from Holden audiences. In my book, The Rapture Exposed, there's at least 5 things that people at Holden came up with in sessions like this, so I'm planning on that happening today and tomorrow as well. And I will footnote you. Okay, Leviticus 25. Let's start with reading verse 8. If one of you would read Leviticus 25, 8 to 12, loudly, and that would be our sort of Jubilee intro here.
You shall count off 7 weeks of years, 7 times 7 years. So the period of 7 weeks of years gives 49 years. Then you shall have the trumpet sounded loud on the 10th day of the 7th month, on the Day of Atonement. You shall have the trumpet sounded throughout all your land. And you shall hallow the 50th year, and you shall proclaim liberty throughout the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee for you. You shall return, every one of you, to your property, every one of you to your family. That 50th year shall be a jubilee for you. You shall not sow or reap the aftergrowth or harvest the unpruned vines, for it is a jubilee. It shall be holy to you. You shall eat only what the field itself produces.
Okay, let's just stop there for now. That we haven't gotten to the sort of redemption of slaves or land yet, but the idea then of a jubilee year is here in Leviticus 25. And so why we have it and Holden as Jubilee Day today is because Holden loves festivals and celebrations. Our last one was 4th of July. You go to this two-meal kind of shift where you eat and eat, and all kinds of funny things happen. There might be a parade, their equivalent of it is the auction today. So we are counting this as the 50th day of the summer program. So it's completely arbitrary because it's not even the start of summer on June 21. It's the start of summer program, which I think was like June 8th or something. So that's why today is a jubilee. It's the 50th of something. Okay. And it gives us an occasion for jubilation and jubilee. So we've completely gone off the liturgical calendar of the, you know, historic church, and we've created our own liturgical season that is the season of summer programming that starts June 8th, and now we're on the 50th day, so we're going to blow the trumpet and declare this to be the new year, and the new year happens to be the 50th year, which is a jubilee year. So today we're going to explore all kinds of ways, funny and provocative and challenging, that we can reflect on this jubilee theme together. All right, let's read a little more of the text, and you'll then hear, of course, Bishop David Brower-Rieke at Matins today introduce us to the section that begins with verse 29, this idea about if your house is in a walled city, then this doesn't even apply if you don't redeem it the first year. But let's, just to hear some of these jubilee principles.
And we're going to blow it off one more time.
Yeah.
And for all those who aren't included, just run right over.
Yeah, but you have to metaphorically say that Portland has a wall. But in a sense, I mean, this is, let me just, I want to read a quote from Norman Gottwell that will set the stage for our entire discussion today. Hopefully that will help us all know that it does, none of this applies to any of us in one sense, because it applies to ancient Israel. But in a sense, then, the question is, how does any of it apply to any of us, even people in Portland, if you metaphorically think Portland has a wall? Okay. So Norman Gottwald says, of the whole Old Testament and of Old Testament studies, we are left with the logically perplexing but morally empowering paradox that the Bible is both grossly irrelevant in direct application to current economic problems and incredibly relevant in vision and principle for grasping opportunities and obligations to make the whole earth and its bounty serve the welfare of the whole human family. And I would say it doesn't just apply to economic concerns either. All the questions of the Old Testament are both grossly irrelevant to us today, but also incredibly relevant in terms of vision and principle. And that's what we want to grapple with today. Then, as you read through this chapter, it's going to seem really strange. And if you read through the whole book of Leviticus, it would also seem really strange. We're going to do a little bit of that because this is in the context of a long book. So the question as we go through today is any of this applicable to us, given that we now have a totally different system of property rights and we have capitalism? I mean, you'll see, if you want to jump ahead to verse 37, let's just get that one out of the way or on the table. Would someone read 37 and 38 for us?
You shall not lend them your money at interest taken in advance or provide them food at a profit. Oh dear. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan to be your God.
Okay. I should have started with 36. Do not take interest in advance or otherwise make a profit, but fear the Lord your God. Anyway, I don't know if this comes as a shock to anybody, but the Bible is quite consistent and prolific in these prohibitions on the lending of money at interest. Does anybody ever lend money for interest in this room? Well, you might not realize you're lending it, but if you have any kind of interest, you're actually lending your money. The ELCA Mission Investment Fund even operates by, we lend them our money, they pay interest, and then the money gets lent to congregations who need to build a building or something like that. So right there.
And Barbara, if you have a bank account.
I know. Yeah. Anybody. Right. So this obviously wouldn't work now. I mean, or we have to ask in what sense. Okay. So let's just read a few of the other sections, though, and then we'll kind of start in on what on earth do we do with this. Okay. Would somebody read verses 13? Well, let's just read a lot of it. 13 to 17, and then somebody else could read 18 to 24.
In this year of Jubilee, you shall return every one of you to your property. When you make a sale to your neighbor or buy from your neighbor, you shall not cheat one another. When you buy from your neighbor, you shall pay only for the number of years since the Jubilee. The seller shall charge you only for the remaining crop years. If the years are more, you shall increase the price. And if the years are fewer, you shall diminish the price. For it is a certain number of harvests that are being sold to you. You shall not cheat one another, but you shall fear God. For I am the Lord your God.
Somebody want to read 18? Let me just say, if you jump ahead to verse 23 here, the reason that all you're buying is harvests. You can't actually buy them. That's why the sale price is going to be discounted at a discount rate that is, you know, 49/50, 40, you know, 48/50, like that, because you're only buying the harvest, because in verse 23 is going to be the key. The land shall not be sold in perpetuity, for the land is mine, God says. So God owns the land. We're on it for those harvests. And God goes on to say here, with me, you are but aliens and tenants. So this is a really interesting notion of property that is quite quite different. Who is it? I was trying to think. Who's the quote from? You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you odd. is it Dorothy Day? Who said it's Flannery O'Connor. Okay, Flannery O'Connor. Leviticus, the whole book of Leviticus would be like that. The idea of Leviticus is holiness, to make us a holy people, which basically is going to make us odd. So everything here is going to be odd, but it's the notion of holiness, of being different from other people. And you'll see the chapter is just replete with this. And would it ever work to carry this out? Well, Israel was supposed to. I mean, it's a thread. It's enough of a thread in the Old Testament and then in the New that it's still in a vision and principle long after. Okay, somebody want to read 18 through 24? Actually, let's skip skip that then. Nobody wants to read it. Let's do 25, because we don't have time to do everything. So this becomes really interesting here, starting with verse 25.
If any one of your kin falls into difficulty and sells a piece of property, then the next of kin shall come and redeem what the relative has sold. If the person has no one to redeem it, but then prospers and finds a sufficient means to do so, the years since its sale shall be computed, and the difference shall be refunded to the person to whom it was sold, and the property shall be returned. But if there is not sufficient means to recover it, what was sold shall remain with the purchaser until the year of Jubilee. In the Jubilee it shall be released, and the property shall be returned.
Okay. Then the next section is what David Brower-Ricky told us about vans, that it doesn't apply in the same way for houses in walled cities. They're different from houses in villages. Then, if you look at verse 32 and following, this is how we know that this text was written by the author that we call the priestly writer, or the holiness writer, because there's a whole section here about how Levites get special pleading. They get a better deal. And so,
Can I back up and ask a question about what we just read?
Yes.
Because you said that the land is mine, but then he says if anyone sells a piece of property. So why are we selling property if the land is not theirs?
It's probably the word sell isn't the best translation here. And this is where I have to tell you that I'm a New Testament professor, so I didn't look up the Hebrew. I mean, I could get a Hebrew Bible out here and we could have it open, but... It's not sell in the same sense that we understand it. It's maybe more like lease, but you lose it for a time, but you're always going to get it back. The best example of that is in 1 Kings 21. If anybody wants to look at that, you know this story. This is Naboth's vineyard that Ahab tries to buy, you know, wicked king. And Naboth says, I can't sell it to you. You don't sell land. You can't sell land. The Lord, my God, has prohibited sale. I mean, he physically can't sell something. So it's that idea that land has a different kind of prohibition on selling. So sell isn't the same as what we mean by sell. You don't actually sell it to somebody else and thereby lose claim to it. So it's this whole wonderful Old Testament notion of inheritance, of your nahala, is your family holding, your family plot. You can never actually sell the family farm to someone and have it be clear title in their name. That isn't how it works, because it turns out it all belongs to God and you're the family farmer who it's allotted to. And at a certain point, it's always going to get redeemed. It's going to be bought back. So the Hebrew for redeemer is this word that applies to God who redeems people out of Egypt, and then it also applies to the person, the redeemer. The Goel is the name who's going to redeem land or slaves back when they've been lost in this 50th year. So let's read verse 39 to, actually it has to start with 35, if any of your kin. Because one of the elements with this chapter that I think can be problematic for us, and should be, is that there's a distinction made between Israelites who can't ever permanently become slaves, and others who can. And this chapter actually seems to support slavery and was used in the slave debates of the 19th century. So we have to have a caution about this chapter. But again, it's this, you shall know the truth shall make you odd idea. Israelites were in a different category from non-Israelites at this point as far as how long the slavery could last. But we better read it all, and then you'll know what we've got. But we'll try to focus on the good parts. So would somebody read 35 through 38?
If any of your kin fall into difficulty and become dependent on you, you shall support them. They shall live with you as though resident aliens.
All right, actually we already read the next part, so let's skip over that. Sorry. 39 then is the basis for all this. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. Okay, so if you would read 39 following, that would be great.
If any who are dependent on you become so impoverished that they sell themselves to you, you shall not make them serve as slaves. They shall remain with you as hired or bound laborers. They shall serve with you until the year of the Jubilee. Then they and their children with them shall be free from your authority. They shall go back to their own family and return to their ancestral property.
for they are my servants, whom I brought out of the land of Egypt.
Okay, so that's for the Israelites. That's for your kin. But there's a little bit different for those who aren't from Israel. And that's what we're going to begin with, verse 44. Man, I've got to get my glasses on. If you would start there, sorry.
As for the male and female slaves whom you may have, it is from the nations around you that you may acquire male and female slaves.
See how this was used to justify slave trade from Africa and, you know, okay, so there you are. From the nations around you, it's okay.
You may also acquire them from among the aliens residing with you and from their families that are with you, who have been born in your land, and they may be your property. You may keep them as a possession for your children after you, for them to inherit as property. These you may treat as slaves, but as for your fellow Israelites, no one shall rule over the other with harshness.
Okay, we'll stop there for now. There's one more section here about the Jubilee again. But anyway, isn't it interesting how these, and this is not in the lectionary, I don't think, at least I never read it in the lectionary. Maybe I missed that Sunday. But so what do we do with something like this? Indeed, what do we do with the entire book of Leviticus? Because I think you can't just, I mean, I love the sections of Leviticus 25 that can be used for addressing things. When we had the millennium 9 years ago, there was talk in the World Council of Churches about the idea of Jubilee for debts, for the global debt crisis. I mean, I've used it in that way, all kinds of ways. There's sections of this I really, really love as a vision. But it's written by the priestly writer, or the holiness writer, who also writes the rest of Leviticus, so we've got to grapple with that. But let me just tell you a book that I used this spring in a course, a brand new book that I really, really love and want to share with you, because she actually has a very positive reading of Leviticus. This is by Ellen Davis, an Old Testament professor at Duke Divinity School, called Scripture, Culture, and Agriculture, an Agrarian Reading of the Bible. And let me just read a little piece here of her project, because it's so interesting. I'm in the Roman numerals. Aha. Here we go. This volume explores the agrarian mindset of the biblical writers by bringing Israel's scriptures into sustained conversation with the works of contemporary agrarian writers, most consistently those of farmer, poet, essayist, and fiction writer Wendell Berry. So she sets up, because her argument is, and I think this is very true for the Old Testament, that the Israelites were such agricultural people, and the whole vision through the Old Testament, I mean, Dave is right, cities don't factor in any positive way until the New Testament, really. It's all about peasant farmers and empires ruling over them, and what agricultural life should be, and how God teaches us about how to relate to one another through the land and through our relationships on the land. And she thinks that Wendell Berry, Wes Jackson, and other contemporary agrarian writers who, and now it's getting picked up, you know, by Michael Pollan with The Omnivore's Dilemma, Barbara Kingsolver's latest book, Animal Vegetable Miracle, all these people who write about food, agricultural eating as important, I think are in a kind of trajectory that Ellen Davis in this book sets in conversation with Old Testament texts in a wonderful way. My students loved this book this spring, and these aren't students who are fabulous in Hebrew. They can make it through, but it's just, it's so interesting. So she has a chapter, her opening chapter is on the prophet Jeremiah's critique of what he saw going on in terms of land and justice issues, and she sets that in conversation with mountaintop removal issues today. Then she's got a great chapter on Genesis 1. I'm so glad you did it, Dave, the other day, because a lot of us environmentalists tend to say, oh, Genesis 1 is a problem, but Genesis 2 is great, because this is more the farming chapter. No, she does Genesis 1 much the way you did. Is a kind of liturgical poem with the refrain of goodness. Mm-hmm. And she uses this wonderful quote, so much of our ecological crisis is a failure in perceiving what is good. And so if we can go back to Genesis 1 and get this theme of goodness going, and also she does this wonderful thing with all the seeds, the refrain of seeds in Genesis 1. Then she has a chapter that is I'm using in my own work called Leaving Egypt Behind, the Wilderness Economy, focusing on this notion that Dan Erlander has developed up here in Holden Lot on the idea of manna as a kind of counter-narrative. I mean, everything that manna story is supposed to teach us about, there's going to be enough, but you're not supposed to hoard it. And on the seventh day, you trust that you will have gotten enough. On the sixth day, if you hoard it, it's going to rot. And then even as you go into other places, out of the wilderness, you take that jar of manna somehow, whatever that is liturgically, to remind you of this important identity that is so counterintuitive, a manna identity, which is a contrast to the iron smelting furnace of Egypt. She's got this wonderful quote that I had never seen in Deuteronomy, how Egypt is perceived as this sort of burning, consuming, smelting economy in contrast to this notion of manna. And that Israel has a kind of healing vision that is what manna reminds them. All right, then chapter 5 is what I want to tell you about today. It's called Reading Leviticus, a Wholesome Materiality. And I was glad to encounter this chapter because I've never had anything particularly positive of how to do a read of Leviticus other than Leviticus 25. Of course, you can jump to that and it sounds great. But here's her claim. This is very interesting. She says, Leviticus articulates, perhaps more fully than anywhere else in Scripture, a theologically profound vision of the interdependence and complexity of the created order. And it grapples with the difficult question of how humans may responsibly participate in that created order. And then she brings in Wendell Berry. But her take, because, you know, Leviticus is full of all these purity laws that are quite dreadful. But the sort of core chapter of Leviticus, she points out, and everybody would agree with this, is chapter 19, where God sets up this idea of holiness, that you are to be a holy people, the sanctification of all of life. And then the problem is, in Leviticus 18, I'm already slanting things. I should just say, the way it's laid out, what a holy life is going to look like, she says it's a kind of democratizing of holiness that isn't reserved just for priests. It's not just ritual settings that make holiness. It's everything in all of life. And that's why chapter 18 of Leviticus has these 19 prohibitions on doing things that are really strange. And that the New Testament actually rescinds some of them, the idea of unclean and unclean food, but the question is what to do with all these other ones. Like the mixing of two kinds of cloth is prohibited. So if you look in the tag in your shirt right now, unless you're a purist, you know, and you got 100% cotton, I don't look at my tag, but I'm sure that many of us are wearing mixed cloth. But it's prohibited here. If you look at verse 23, she points out, this is fascinating, 18:23. These are the sexual rules here. There's prohibitions on homosexual conduct. There's all kinds of gender things that we would never follow now. I mean, in some ways, it's a kind of dreadful chapter for us. And remember Gottwald saying that it's all irrelevant to us. These are ancient Israelite commands. But she points out the logic of how Leviticus is functioning is to try to embody holiness in all of daily life. So that's what the project of Leviticus is. And then the question is, how does Leviticus 25 fit into this? And she says that it's the fact that the land and the people are both sanctified to God. So there's an analogy between land and people that operates throughout this chapter. The redeeming of the land and the redeeming of the slave, or the person who's fallen into a kind of debt slavery. They all have to be redeemed because everything, land and people, are holy to God. So the laws of redemption are, as we saw in 25, go back and forth between people and property and land that becomes alienated. Oh, here, it's 25:23. Just take a look at that one. Did we read that? I forget. Sorry, Leviticus 25:23. No, I skipped over that one.
Leviticus
Oh, no, we did that one. I'm trying to find the fruit trees that have to remain circumcised. Sorry, I lost my reference here. Yeah, it's really interesting. No, that's in... Well, I didn't write it down. I wrote it down as 1923. Fruit trees. Oh, 1923. That's it. We were looking at 18. Okay, 1923. Yeah, she points this out, that the analogies between land and people even extend to the circumcision laws. 1923 would be correctly translated. When you come into the land and plant all kinds of trees for food, then you shall regard their fruit as uncircumcised. You should have that as a little footnote there. Uncircumcised. So what could be uncircumcised about a fruit tree? I mean, this is the kind of stuff people grapple with, is how on earth does this work? But she says it's all part of this analogous relationship between the people and the land, and that we really are to embody in all our relationship with the land, with all our relationships with people, God's commands of holiness, which of course do include the circumcision. And so that the Leviticus is extending that even to people's relationship with nature, and that's part of what then happens in Leviticus 25. So I want to ask then about this whole notion of redemption that's going on here in Leviticus 25, back to the Jubilee chapter, that something can't be sold ever in perpetuity, the land can't, and that if a person falls into hard times, then you've got to help them get redeemed. A redeemer has to come along, somebody with more means, or someone who's a relative of that person, and you've got to get the land back, and you've got to get the family members back if they've temporarily gone into slavery. Because I think that it's that idea of redemption maybe that can apply to us in a challenging way. I mean, we Lutherans, and I want to say I am a Lutheran, and I really believe in the forgiveness of sins. But forgiveness and redemption in the New Testament, it's this same word, aphia, means the verb. And what Leviticus is doing is saying that people also have a role in redemption. Especially in this 50th year, redemption happens, and we're all going to join in by helping one another come to that redeemed situation. So what Ellen Davis says here is that redemption becomes a kind of socio-economic institution because that word is used of God. I'm the Lord who redeemed you out of Israel. And then it's also applied to people within the Israelite community about how they have to redeem one another, get back, and it's an economic word, and they need to redeem the land, get that back, if it's temporarily fallen into somebody else's hands. So what I want to open up now is this question of, are there places then in our lives, in our world, that you could imagine these notions of Leviticus 25, however odd they are, possibly informing us? And remember again, Norman Gottwald's pointing out, there's no direct application. They are irrelevant in terms of direct application to current economic problems. Obviously, we already started charging interest several hundred years ago, so the whole system wouldn't work. But is there a way in which this is incredibly relevant in terms of vision and principle? And what might those be?
Well, I'll talk about the dark side of it, and it's how it's being used within Israel to have the land be under the state of sort of a foundation or something under Israel, where it's all gathered into Israel, and Palestinians are deprived of their land and are not allowed to own the land within Israel, and that the settlers, Israeli settlers, up to 500,000 now, have taken between East Jerusalem and the West Bank property, over half of the West Bank, have that under control and do not want to release it. And see that from these Levitical laws, their justification for that. And of course, you just were over there in May, I understand, leading another group, so I'm sure you can speak a lot about this issue.
No, in January, yeah.
January, okay.
Yeah. No, it absolutely has a dark side. Thank you for pointing out that one.
I was in the dark there too, and that's my concern. The Palestinians have been stripped of their land, and are devious. The law of Israel is stacked against them in the strictest and most solid of ways. And this whole call from God to, once the people have just lost it, you know, because they were irresponsible or incapable, they should too be helped. But when it's directly when the landowners are continuing to solidify their grip, that biblical principle seems to me to be ever more relevant. And for anybody with a smidgen of faith or hope for righteousness should be listening.
This is really interesting to me, Rosa. Let me just say, Norman Gottwald, he has a different article, not that I read the quote from, he has a different article where he actually says we should be very cautious about this text as well, because he proposes, and this is a minority Old Testament opinion, I mean, Ellen Davis loves this text. Norman Gottwald thinks, though, that it actually was written in a similar kind of circumstance, that it's written after the exile. Remember, after Jerusalem falls in 587 BC, then the elites get taken off into exile in Babylon, but the lowly people are left on the land, and so they probably started farming the land of those who had been taken away involuntarily, and so Gottwald thinks that this chapter was written in order to justify a kind of land grab under the Persian time, then the restoration, when the elites who had been taken away came back and wanted to get their land back, they wrote this to say, here's why. It's ours. It never could have been taken in perpetuity. Give me my land back. So Gottwald thinks it's a problematic text, as are most of the texts of the priestly writer. A lot of people would say, now the problem is the priestly or holiness writer was the last one to shape the Pentateuch, so is the most important. But there's certainly that caution. Thank you for bringing that up. And
we need to be cautious in letting Scripture justify our particular. I've got to be this kind of.
Yeah, I haven't looked at it, but there's a book in the bookstore, you know, that's a bestseller now. But I think it sounds kind of hokey. But it's that The Year of Living Biblically by a Jewish writer.
Yeah.
If you try to take literally all the commands in the Old Testament, what it would look like. And I'm sure, you know, he's got other ones that are odder than this even. But so you can't take stuff literally. So analogically, is there anything helpful here? And you know, this whole question of like in East Germany, after the wall came down, do people get their property back who had left East Germany? But there's people living there now. What do you do about that? Or Jews after the Holocaust, that you know, of course, repatriation of property in Germany that was taken from them, all of that. But how do you handle that in Israel? Because it's totally different there.
And look at Native Americans on reservations. We had their land sold by the government to white settlers on reservation lands.
Yeah. So, does anybody see anything positive here that you can use? Dave?
No! I think the value of being odd in a system, I mean, if we look at Jubilee, not as the one who gets our property back, because that's the abusive part we're talking about, but the one who's actually going to free somebody or forgive a debt. I mean, to be odd in the system, I think, is a nice law gospel thing. It's to say, I'm going to do this, and you're going to say, what the heck is Dave doing? And I'm going to let my action critique the system in which we live. You know, why would it, this is the law in the theological sense. This says, don't you see how broken our world is? So that's, I think it's totally unfunctional. I think you're right. Economically, it's totally unfunctional. It does not make sense. It defeats the very things we're trying to do, but it raises the question of whether what we're trying to do is really functional or not. So that's the only positive thing I see about that.
Barbara, way up here, cheap seats. I think a very positive thing is that it's a reminder for us. Israelites lived in lands of idols. Possessions can become idols. I think the Lord wanted to share with us, even today, how we should treat our possessions. And I see this as very positive. It's a structure that, if carried to its fullest, creates in us a stewardship of our possessions.
Land that you don't have absolute ownership, you're
absolutely
stewarding.
And we have a responsibility today, and I see this as a real, I don't want to to say wake-up call, but it's a real reminder of where we are in God's plan for everyone.
Thank you. The word tenants and, the land belongs to God. Uh-huh. Okay, Dale?
We have seen the wisdom of estate taxes, but then we have created a corporation that is considered a person but never dies. And what we are seeing is the result of growing global corporations with ever-growing power and control and influence on our life and our whole way of life. Very destructive.
Wow. Great. You sound like a radical. Okay, David Carson. Yeah, and that whole question of whether corporations have the same rights as persons and all that. Okay, thank you. You had a hand up.
Uh-huh. I was just going to piggyback off the comment that was made previously. A connection with the Catholic social teaching I was hearing when we were reading.
Oh, yes.
With, again, we don't own it, or we do. But the bigger piece is that, you know, it belongs to God, and we're temporary stewards of our possessions. So.
And Lutheran social teaching, too. But yeah, Catholic social teaching, the Pope's newest statement that just came out, I think, 2 weeks ago, about a critique of greed and what that turns into if it's absolute. No, I think every Christian can learn from this text about our relationships with possessions and with one another, and that selling isn't, that there's not absolute property rights that go in the biblical vision. Gloria.
Along the part that speaks of supporting those in the family who've fallen on hard times, within my family, My grandmother immigrated to the U.S., as did many members of her family, because times were tough in Norway. At one point, the small family farm was used as a assurance for a business deal. That deal fell through, and the family farm in Norway was lost. But all the relatives in America, who would never see that farm again because there was no way to visit back and forth, sent money back to Norway to redeem that family farm, which to this day is still in the family.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh. Wow.
Or how many of you own land in the United States or buildings?
How many own land?
Land or buildings in the United States?
You kept our houses.
Land. Yeah, your houses. Yeah. Well, yeah. Oh, that's not your property? Right? How many of you think you own it absolutely?
No.
Wells Fargo Bank owns mine. They pay that every month to allow me to stay there.
No, no, really. I mean,
so even if you have the deed, you say absolutely.
That's just a loan. But actually, in every state in the United States, the state is the only state that owns, is the only entity that owns your land absolutely. What happens if you don't pay your property tax?
Yeah.
Eminent domain. So in fact, two people own your land.
Uh-huh.
The state and you. And you may in fact let somebody else use your land. Right. So in this chapter, and I'm always here at Jubilee, and I always get asked to talk about the economics of Jubilee. Who's the entity that owns the land in this chapter?
God.
No, the family.
Oh, yes.
Right? Everything returns to the family. Every obligation is stated in terms of whether this person is part of your family or not. Right? The obligations for people who are outside of your community, some say aliens, some say countrymen, as opposed to the translations are different on the word. Then in some sense, the collective ownership is this family unit, and that part cannot be alienated. So the redemption occurs within the social unit that God owns the land, and that's made manifest in this kin group. Now, I don't know enough about the Old Testament to know, but...
Yeah, so I think we have to ask then, is there a way in which we can have a bigger kin group? But yeah,
that's
thank
right.
you. And so, yeah, the direct application, I mean, it's thank you for all these, yeah, and it's very important to know that this idea of absolute property rights isn't even in the United States now. I've been reading a lot of... a legal scholar, Eric Freifogel, who does a lot on the whole concept of private property and property rights and stuff, because I think there's, as you say, the double...
It's a lot more complicated than it is.
Yeah. All right, let me just...
When it talks about the redemption is only of the land and of the people, and that we are sustained? Because it doesn't talk about redemption of any other living creatures. It's just the people in the land. So is it?
Yes, and that's an important question. And, you know, I didn't look at the Hebrew enough to know if it's that word Adama. I think the word for land would be Eretz. So Haaretz here, I think, is what's going on. But it is certainly that idea, then, of the question of the rest of creation. What stake do the animals have? The laws of gleaning, I think, go a little bit that direction, that you're not allowed to plow. We didn't read those because they're in a different chapter. You can't plow right up to your fence lines or whatever. You've got to leave the bushes that are the hedges. So I think there is a provision for animals, but it's not right in this chapter. And then you can't go back a second time and harvest again. You have to leave. If you don't get it on your first pass through, then you leave it for the poor and for the animals. So there is a lot of care in Leviticus for the animals, although it doesn't come out here, but thank you. And I think, all right, let me go into what I'm working on now. This is going to be a stretch, okay? I'm going to try to make it seem like a logical transition, but in fact, I'm now going to go into my direction. But this, if there is a segue, that was it, so thank you so much. because I think what we can ask with this text is, what are our debts that need to be redeemed, and what might that look like then? Who are the debts we're incurring to? And a number of environmentalists will talk about a debt to nature, that the as we take off the topsoil at rates that are unsustainable, that this could be viewed as a kind of debt. Now, I haven't framed stuff in terms of debt language in my book so far, but I'm using today as a test case to see if it might work or not. Many people do, and they'll talk about then, because I'm working on the climate change crisis a lot with New Testament texts and how we can approach that. Both David Brower, Ricky, even though he sounds like a grumpet man, he actually is quite an expert on this topic. He and I went to Al Gore's climate training last October for faith-based leaders. And he is on the governor's task force, and it's a lot of tough issues, but sort of how to frame the crisis of global warming in persuasive terms for our time, which is incredibly complex, of course. But one of the ways some people do it is in terms of climate debt and even climate slavery. That in terms of the science of global warming, here's the deal, is that carbon dioxide has such a long half-life that you can't just stop emitting it and everything goes away. No, this is good. It's time to show the chart. So good. Yeah, I have this chart. I've been waiting and waiting to show you. There. Okay. Let me explain. So some organizations, now this one was a study that was commissioned by Christian Aid in England. There are others. There's an African-American group that did a climate change proposal in terms of, these are just the ones that look at it in terms of debt, a way of calculating sort of relative amounts of climate debt or whatever. But here's what I especially wanted to show on here, because I think this doesn't get brought up enough. Because carbon dioxide has such a long life, you can't just go with annual emissions to figure out what somebody's share is, how much we owe to other countries. But you have to go with cumulative emissions. And that's, what they decided, though, this is interesting. This is this global, let me go up and I'll find who the source of this is, sorry. I thought I had it here. All right, I'll tell you the source afterwards, I'm really sorry. Anyway, they've, because then you have to decide, well, what year would you start? Because there was a time, whoa. Let me close that. There was a time when we didn't know the problems with global warming. And it wasn't until 1988, for example, even though the Swedish scientist Arrhenius figured it out 100 years ago or more, and others have known about it from a scientific standpoint, it wasn't until James Hansen, our head of the NASA climatology stuff at the Goddard Space Institute in New York, testified before Congress in 1988 about the dangers of human-caused anthropogenic global warming, that we could say you should have known it was a problem. So that's why they choose 1990 as their start year for what's our cumulative emissions since then, because before that you really couldn't have known. So, but still, notice the United States then is responsible for 23%, even though our population is only 4.6%. So some people are saying that could be understood then to be a climate debt. Because if you want to think in terms of sort of every person in the world having an equal share or an equal right to emit or whatever, then when some have incurred a debt of even more than that, then they need to somehow redeem that debt or think about what their share of cutback should be. This is something I want to play around with. I don't actually know. And then in the extreme, other people talk about climate slavery, that we are enslaving future generations. Because the longer we continue to emit, I mean, if you take the science, which says there's going to be an absolute amount that of carbon dioxide past which we shouldn't go, this, it's called the sort of bathtub effect. You can only fill up the bathtub, and then it's going to start, you know, flooding your house. We're pretty close to the top of the bathtub, most would say. So the ones who are really going to suffer from not being able to have carbon emissions at all are our children. So are we putting them into kind of climate slavery? Or poor nations that are already feeling the effects. I was in India in April and visited villages that have already had to move once because of rising sea levels, and all of Bangladesh basically is going to be gone. That's just the reality. And then the Maldives, I mean, all the Pacific Island nations, the sea level rise, they're not redeemable. But what do we owe those people in terms of climate debt? Are we putting them into a kind of climate slavery? And the babies in Narnia, I mean, I was over there yesterday, and I was just thinking, should we try to do some kind of liturgy today where we go over and apologize in advance to the babies, and then ask what we can do to redeem this debt? Because that's really, I think, what's so intriguing in Leviticus is that, yes, God is the one who redeems us out of Egypt, but every person also is called a redeemer, or they're not everybody, but the ones who are able are also called redeemers. So is there some way today that we should think about being redeemers in terms of this debt? And then, and what would that mean? And let me just say a couple of things. In my view, now this is all, now I'm not speaking as a Bible scholar, I'm speaking as a private citizen who's active on the global warming issue. We've got to start taking this seriously as the United States. This bill in Congress, the Waxman-Markley bill, it's very tame, but it's at least something. Our ELCA and all churches, Presbyterians probably have the best statement on this. They've got a great statement, and it was authored by Jim Martin Schramm, who teaches at Holden. He was commissioned by the Presbyterians to write this. It's great. I mean, we really have to think, in my view, in terms of how we're going to change the mentality in our country between now and the Copenhagen negotiations, which is December 8th and following. So you all have a role. And what is our debt to one another in this country? I mean, it doesn't help if the Pacific Northwest and the East Coast people say to the Midwest people, actually, Holden would be a great place. Who's from the Midwest here? Okay. Who's from the Pacific Northwest? Okay. We from the Pacific Northwest have providential electric rates that are unbelievably low. We have a kind of debt to the Midwest, I think, because, you know, in terms of political terms, it's the congressmen and senators from the Midwest who are going to decide whether this bill passes or not. Because they're suffering. The Rust Belt, I mean, look at Michigan. Look at Ohio. It's not fair to impose the same kinds of obligations on everybody when the coal-fired power plants, however problematic they are located in certain parts of the country. So how do we shoulder one another's debt and redeem one another in order to not put those babies in Narnia into climate slavery? And how do we, as a public then, as a church, how do we see one another as our kin, who you can't just finger point? You know, of course everybody should have the same kinds of emission standards that California does. You know, their per capita electricity consumption is half of what it is in Illinois. But if you want, or, you know, if well, here's an example. I've never met her. The South Dakota Congressional Representative, Stephanie Herseth, can't remember her new last name, is a Lutheran. I believe she's been to Holden. She voted against Waxman-Markley because people in South Dakota are so opposed. You know, it's farmers are opposing it. So you have to do horse trading. I mean, we all have to shoulder one another's burdens and debts in order to convince, to make the case to the rest of the world that the United States is serious about this. So how do we do that? And are there ways in which we can be redeemers for one another for different parts of the country and help one another move in the way that it's going to be hard to do, but we need to do and can do to take seriously this climate debt, the fact that the United States has been 23% up until now. And yeah, India and China are coming right up. I mean, they're cumulative emissions. Look at 15% for India and 4.2 for China, 4.2 for India. China has now passed us in terms of annual total emissions, but they have five times the population that we do. Per capita, Canada is worse than the United States. Australia is worse. Other countries are worse. We're not the worst per capita, but because we're the biggest in terms of population, our number is just huge. So that's just a proposal, that one thing to think about how any of this might help us is the logic of sort of, if we have a climate debt, if there's a risk of climate slavery, then how might Jubilee be a time when we can think about redeeming that debt in terms of our relationships with our neighbors and one another? Okay, let me go on. What do you think of that notion? Is that going to go anywhere or not? I've never tried it before.
Mr. Parker, would you explain how they got the responsibility the RCI means?
Yes, the RCI, here, I'll go up here. Yes, it's the... because that's our responsibility, then gets even higher. It's in terms of income. I'm sorry, I should have known this. Yes, here's the reference here. It's the Right to Development in a Climate-Constrained World, the Greenhouse Development Rights Framework. That's the reference up there. See, this is an article from Jim Martin Schramm. I'm just hopelessly... they come up with this responsibility and capacity index that has to do with, here it is, national capacity is the amount by which a country's per capita income exceeds this development threshold that they've defined as, $9,000 per person. So there, what's good about this framework, I think, is that even within a country, they acknowledge there's rich people and poor people. So even China and India have a certain responsibility. I should have studied this article better, but that's what it is this responsibility capacity index. That's the RCI for individual nations and groups of nations and people within nations. It's an interesting document. Pardon me for looking around at this and not knowing my material, but that's what that is. The responsibility capacity index is by per capita income average. But then it means that each person who's above that target, that basic threshold of $9,000 per year, would help shoulder other people's responsibility. I mean, so you could call it like a tax or something. But I think what's good about Jubilee is it reminds us it is possible to redeem a debt. You just do something. I mean, so we think of forgiveness as being only God can do that. No, this chapter is saying if you're you're exceeding a certain thing, then you help other people get out of that. And there's a kind of bear one another's burdens that I think is an interesting concept in Jubilee. So sorry, I didn't tell you that about the chart.
It strikes me, however, in wrestling with this chapter over the years, that this is all about the people who incurred the debt not having to redeem it.
Well, because right? They're unable.
Right.
But they're relatives.
But we can't take the message of Jubilee to say people should pay back their debts. Right? Because the point of Jubilee is about what happens in situations where people can't pay back the debt, or there's a change in circumstances, how do we adjust to that? So it's the law, the point that the United States should pay back 31% of the cost of cleaning up global warming, I'm all for that. I don't have a problem with that. It's not Jubilee.
It's not an analogy.
That's the law. The Jubilee is intended to be the exception for it, not...
Yeah. No, you're right. The analogy breaks down there, because if we put the babies in Narnia into a kind of climate slavery, it wouldn't be the same people who would redeem them. But I'm suggesting that maybe we could see ourselves on both sides of this equation in a way. But you're correct. The analogy is not in the text.
Well, if it works, go for it.
Yeah. Okay. Uh-huh, Dale?
I'm going to sound like a stuck record. The purpose of Jubilee is to rebalance power. And in our country, we have had... And when we formed our country, we said there has to be a balance of power. So we ended up with divisions of government. We said that church can't have too much power. The military must be separate from the legislative. In other words, we were power conscious. We've now reached a point where we have developed this corporation community that has tremendous power over what our government does, over what we do. We need to find a way of regaining a balance of power between our will and the corporate will.
Okay, so that I think you're doing then what Gottwald suggested, which is taking the visions and principles of this chapter and saying the rebalancing of power every 50 years is a very important thing that Jubilee was intended to enact for people. I that works for me. How about the rest of you? Anybody else? I forgot I had these other texts on the board here. So would you put that paper in front of the projector again? Is that possible? Okay. And I think that's some of what you see. If anybody's more interested in, it's really interesting. Walter Brueggemann has this quote where he says, of all the texts in the Bible, this is the one that people most ask me, this was never implemented, was it? And he says, and it's always asked negatively. He goes, there's so many other passages in the Bible, people always focus on this one. I can't read the quote without my glasses. People want to assume, it never was implemented, was it? Well, the question is, do you make an argument from negative? These two passages are Jeremiah railing against people and Nehemiah that they haven't been observing it, that they've been collecting interest. And so, but normally when you hear a prophet or somebody saying the negative, you know, you're not doing this, that means there was an expectation still that you would. There's some kind of expectation. And and then many scholars would suggest that it's in Isaiah 61 when it's talking about the year of the Lord's favor, and that's what Jesus picks up on in Luke 4 when he, opens the scroll. This is sort of the inaugural speech in Luke, and says, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me, has anointed me to preach good news to the poor, liberty to the captive, and to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. So some would say you couldn't possibly live out this Jubilee text, don't even try, but others would say it was still alive in Israel's memory all through time, because this is after the restoration, and enough so that people could at least invoke it and say, you're not doing this, why not? So it hadn't completely dropped out. And so just for today, let's see, as many of you have mentioned, are there little and big ways or funny ways that we can think about being redeemers, taking away somebody else's debt, and then I was suggesting with that climate thing, even taking away our own debt, or at least thinking about not just doing the way of the world, but readjusting power and talking about what that might look like on this, the 50th day of summer. Okay, thanks everybody.